Welcome to Mast Cell Matters, deep dives on mast cell activation syndrome, or MCAS, with Dr. Tanya Dempsey. This is a monthly feature of the POTSCast, the weekly nonprofit podcast of Standing Up to POTS. If you would like to hear all of our great episodes about POTS and related medical conditions, please consider subscribing. Now, please enjoy this episode of Mast Cell Matters.
Hello, mast cell patients and beautiful people who care about mast cell patients. I'm Jill Brooke, and this is Mast Cell Matters, where we go deep on all things related to mast cell activation syndrome, or MCAS, with the help of our wonderful, amazing guest host, Dr. Tanya Dempsey. She is the mast cell universe expert in my mind. She's a physician and researcher extraordinaire, expert on mast cell disease and other sorts of immune dysfunction. And Dr. Dempsey, thank you so much for hosting today. Who did you bring with you?
Oh, I am really excited to have my go-to person in the world of mold, Michael Rubino. He is the CEO of Change the Air Foundation, which we all need to hear about. And he is the ultimate expert in mold remediation. I've known Michael for a number of years, and he just is so well-versed in this topic. And I think this is something that all our listeners really need to hear about. So let's dive in.
Hooray! Thank you. And can I give a little bit of context just to Michael? That in mast cell activation syndrome, all of us patients have our immune systems going crazy. And the thing that we're taught, the number one rule of MCAS is if you can, try to identify and then avoid your triggers. And mold is such a trigger for most of us, but avoiding it is so hard, and you get all this different information, and then it's a nightmare. And so we're really grateful to have you be an authority on how to avoid it and get rid of it.
Totally. Thank you so much for having me. And of course, you know, I don't know as much about MCAS as you guys, of course, but I have dipped my toe in the water of understanding, you know, how it affects, especially with mold exposure and how that kind of creates this massive issue of triggers, right? And so been doing this for a long time and really excited to kind of dive in today.
Great. Well, so again, thank you for being here. So why don't we talk a little bit about your background and how you've come to this place where you are now as, you know, basically co-founder of Change the Air Foundation.
Yeah. So the story starts with me, you know, coming home after college and working for my dad. My dad was a restoration contractor since I'm about 5 years old. And, you know, Hurricane Sandy hits the Northeast and I start seeing a pattern of people getting sick. And I was about 20 something at the time. And so in my 20s, you know, for the first time seeing people getting sick in their own homes, a light bulb goes off. Like, cause for me, no one talked about that stuff in school or anything like that. When I went to the doctor, no one's ever asked me, you know, do I have any symptoms because I'm staying in a moldy building or something like that. As a matter of fact, I grew up with asthma as a kid and actually ditched asthma by the time I was 8 years old, when I moved from New York in like a moldy apartment building to a single family home in New Jersey. And so, you know, as I start putting all this together and really started noticing this pattern of people getting sick, I decided, well, why is that happening? And I started doing a lot of research. And one of the things that I really found profound at the time was, you know, with mold, for example, obviously water damage takes shape first, right? Water comes into the building. It allows this ability for mold to grow. And, you know, going back to, I think the standards at the time were the 2006 IICRC S520 standards. They've evolved a lot over the years, and I love that organization. It's phenomenal in terms of certifications and standardizations. But at that time, you know, no one was talking about mycotoxins, right? It was something that I found in my research. No one was really talking about how mold creates spores and particles that fragment across the house. Because really it just, the whole protocol was set up a containment and just remove that wall. And so as I started to realize, well, we have living organisms that create particles that create toxins, those distribute across the house, especially with modern mechanical systems, right? HVAC systems. Why aren't we talking about how do you fully assess and fully handle the situation? And furthermore, you know, at this point in time, I'm getting a lot of calls from people that already had their house supposedly remediated directly after the storm, but yet still weren't feeling well. And so it really led to, you know, the past 10 years on this massive research project of trying to figure out how do I solve that problem, you know, home by home. And more often, as I started to figure that out, how do I tell that story to help benefit others, which is where this book came out of that I released in 2020. And then after that, and if you had the privilege of reading that book, I talked about this foundation, but it was just an idea. Fast forward to 2024, the foundation's been in existence for 2 years, partnered up with Brandon Chapo, Kendra Seymour, who are also co-founders of the foundation. And we've really put together something absolutely special to help educate people completely for free, to be able to start to put together research programs that will be funding. And of course, that requires support to do so. And policy advocacy work, which, you know, we passed our first bill in Illinois just a couple of weeks ago, which, you know, is really monumental. But, you know, it's just getting started. And that's what's really exciting.
So tell us about the legislation.
So, you know, the story begins with Brandon Chapo. Really, he gets sick in Ohio, and Brandon actually advocates and contacts his legislators, shares his story about how he got sick. He got some media attention around it, and they created the, I think it was called the Healthy Indoor Air Act of Ohio. And that bill did not pass, but that whole story made it to my desk. And I said, you know, I got to reach out to this guy because this is the way we fix things, right? We fix things through legislation. You know, people, unfortunately, they have to get sick to be aware of this thing. And that's just kind of where we're at the current juncture. We actually need to prevent people from getting sick in the first place. And to fill that gap, we actually need the government's assistance in better legislation, better protections for people in communities. And I reached out to Brandon Chapo, and that very first time I saw his whole story, and I was like, look, I have this idea. I want to create this foundation, and I don't think the foundation can be successful without someone like you, you know, really taking what you've learned from the Ohio bill, whether it passed or not, and starting to duplicate that process and help us really make traction across the 50 states and, of course, federally, too. So we did have a federal bill that was proposed last year, the Healthy at Home Act in 2023, and that bill actually was sponsored out of Connecticut, but unfortunately, it just didn't pass. And one thing is challenging, you know, it's very timely. We just had a debate last night, right? Politics is very difficult to navigate, and you've got two different ideologies that, you know, are constantly combating one another. But our goal is to figure out, you know, to shuffle through the noise and figure out how do we reach common ground? Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what you believe in. This is impacting everyone, right?
Well, I was just wondering how a bill can be used to make the air healthier. Is it something about like what the builders have to do, or how does the bill address it?
So, I mean, many different ways the bill addresses this. So first off, as you mentioned, you know, builders, right? So it probably will not surprise you, but no builder in America is educated on actually building homes with a mold perspective in mind. It's just not part of the curriculum. It's not part of the trade. There's no requirement for any builder to be certified in mold, have any understanding of mold or any education. To me, I have a fundamental issue with that. And the reason being is because the builder is building a home and they don't build it properly because they're not required to build it any sort of way other than energy codes and building codes. Well, guess what? As water intrudes in that building process, we're going to have an issue with mold and bacteria growing in those walls. I mean, I am sure that from the three of us, we have heard of at least one person that we can rattle off our head that had a brand new house that had mold in it, right? And so how does something like that exist if not for the way in which we're building homes, which is, you may have heard of a term called dried in, for example. And dried in, what builders think it means, they think it means that they've got some waterproofing on the roof and they've got some waterproofing on the exterior. Maybe there's even some windows installed. But what it actually means is, like it sounds, dried in. The structure is dry. And the house is supposed to be literally dried before you start bringing in something like insulation and drywall. Mm. Well, when's the last time anyone has seen a dehumidifier on a construction site? I mean, honestly, think about it. It just doesn't happen, right? And so we all understand, we have these terms, we all understand there's certain things that are supposed to happen, but no builder is being held accountable for that because they don't think it's a big deal. And so as long as we create a system where we don't think it's a big deal and we don't hold people accountable for that, well, we're creating this perpetual system where builders come in, they don't think anything of it, and they're building moldy homes right from the start. And homes 20 years ago, they took 2 years to build. Today, they're throwing up homes in 3 months.
Yeah.
And so we're taking too many shortcuts, and those shortcuts are leaving us with sicker buildings. And that's really, you know, one of the challenges that we have to face. And so that, to be clear, the Illinois legislation did not address that specific issue. And that's because, you know, talking about politics and how difficult politics is, you need the stepladder approach where you're addressing the low-hanging fruit, right? And then the next time you're proposing bills, you're kind of going up that ladder, because if you try to accomplish everything in one bill, you'll never get it passed. And we've learned that the hard way.
So what did that bill, like, what are you addressing, like, very specifically? And then what do you have to build on to get to the next step?
So that specific bill, I think the biggest achievement is there in Illinois, there is absolutely no licensure for mold inspectors and mold remediators. No licensure, no registry. So what that means is your handyman, someone who knows nothing about mold, can just start working on your bathroom. And unfortunately, cross-contaminate, create a problem, you know, remediate it improperly. I mean, you name it. All the horror stories you ever heard of could happen on that particular project because they're not required to have any sort of education or awareness of how to properly deal with mold. And so one of the biggest points we wanted to address in that specific bill was, let's have Illinois actually have a registry or a licensure program, something that requires people to become certified, prove that they're certified. Right. And actually, otherwise, it becomes unlawful to remediate mold or to test for mold if you don't have the proper knowledge or skill set. And so that really, I mean, I don't know if you guys have heard of some of the horror stories. There's like pest companies that are remediating mold in some states that have no understanding of how to remediate mold. And we're trying to crack down on some of that, because I think people, you know, if people don't know any better, they just, somebody says, well, I'm a mold expert, even though they might not be, you know, there's no protection for them, right? So that was a big thing we wanted to accomplish. The other thing is just updating, like, all of these State Department's websites are archaic. I mean, you know, offline, we talked about earlier how the CDC is still recommending using bleach on their website. It's like, it's literally from 1996. The EPA at least has updated theirs, and they're saying, don't use bleach. Well, if I'm a constituent, and I'm trying to go to a credible source for the right information, and I see CDC says I could use bleach and EPA says absolutely don't use bleach, I'm confused, right? And so and it gets even worse when you go on the State Department's websites. You go to the state of Illinois and you say mold. I mean, it was a mess. And so they're with our guidance, they're updating all of their public health information and all the information that they give out to the public. And I believe they're also coming up with ways to, you know, mass educate the public as well. And so these are two crucial parts of the bill that are really allow us to make change. And it's not massive change. We still have big problems to fix, right? We still have the builder issue. We have a home insurance issue to deal with. We have health insurance issue to deal with. There's still big issues to deal with, but this allows us to take those steps and say, hey, listen, at least we need to educate the public so they're better equipped to make good choices. And then at least we need to make sure we're protecting the public. When they do have issues, they can hire the right people and not just people that are, you know, claiming they can deal with it, but they have no idea how to deal with it, right? And so those are two things we're really proud about, you know, with this specific bill.
That's amazing.
Boy, there's so much to it. And
boy, I have to laugh because it resonated with me when you talked about a handyman who comes in claiming to be able to address your mold. Because last week when I spoke to Dr. Dempsey about the sheds that had been built to be my office and a gym, and the contractor had used moldy lumber to begin with and said, oh, it's fine. It's no big deal. This is how we do it. Then I called three different mold remediation companies, and one said they could do a dry fog that would take care of it. One said they could do a mold bomb that would take care of it. And a third said that he could spray something else. But when I looked into these products, they were either things that I could just go to the hardware store and buy myself, or they were things that had zero information about them at all. And then I did notice that nobody was licensed. And I thought, whoa, so people can just come in with chemicals, charge you $1,000, and that was for tiny, tiny sheds. I can't imagine what it is for a whole house. And you have no idea what you're getting, but that's why I was so excited to find your resource. But can I ask, where does the good definitive information come from? Like, has there been studies on this, or who are the right people to talk about this?
Yeah. So unfortunately, a lot of the information is kind of piecemealed all over the place. And one of the real things that Change the Air wanted to address was taking all that information that's piecemealed. You have to go to this organization to find this and that organization to find that. And we created a lot of free resources for people. You know, there are so many amazing free resources at changetheairfoundation.org. I encourage anyone listening to please go and check them out, because when you're confused trying to figure out how do you navigate this, it can be extremely alarming. You call six different contractors, they tell you 12 different things, right? You ask them questions, they're backpedaling on their answers. I mean, it can be extremely overwhelming, and it, you know, you're dealing with your health and you don't know who to trust. It becomes really difficult. And we wanted to make sure that we're taking all of the best information from some of the best organizations out there and kind of putting it all together. And so I think, you know, when you look at those resources, I think you'll really grasp. And everything is cited, so you know exactly where the information came from. There's no questions or doubts on that. With respects to like the actual industry and all these different people and licensors, I mean, you know, unfortunately, I don't really like any of those chemicals. I think we live in a world today where I think we know so much about so many different things. You don't need chemicals to remove mold. I want to make that like abundantly clear. And all these bombs and this and that, this isn't it's an industry to sell products. And I think some service-based companies, I believe they get a little lazy and more product dependent. And I just don't feel that that's something that we need to do. I mean, I love the IICR CS520. It's 150 pages plus. You don't have to read it. We have a really good guide that kind of condenses the information of how do you remediate properly right there on Change the Air using those guidelines. But it's what is it? It's really A, protecting cross-contamination from occurring. So when you're disturbing it, you can aerosolize particles that can spread. And the other fundamental is it's elbow grease. You gotta roll up your sleeves, you gotta remove it, right? Not try to kill it. And so now Dr. Dempsey knows how I feel about fogging, right? And unfortunately, it's one of those things that, you know, it sounds good. You know, all these things sound good. You know, Jill, I bet when you have these things in front of you, I could tell your spidey senses were tingling, right? Because you obviously looked into it and you called Dr. Dempsey. But, you know, if you think about the average person, some of these things sound pretty good. And, you know, if you're not an expert in science, you know, you might want to go for some of these strategies, because when you talk to one contractor, maybe it's more cost effective than, you know, trying to do things a little more thoroughly. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if you spend a dollar on something and it doesn't work, you know, it's like a dollar wasted. And so I always caution people, please, you know, do your homework, do your research, talk to a bunch of people, you know, ask a lot of questions, and, you know, make the decision that's right for you and your family. But if it sounds too good to be true, you know, typically that cliche, it probably is.
And let me add, Michael, that I'm a pretty, you know, savvy person. I do a lot of research. I think I'm a little, you know, kind of smart. And I've been tricked by people in this space myself, right? When I had mold in my home back in 2016, 16, 17, or maybe it was earlier than that. You know, I talk to people and do things that I look back and think, well, that was so crazy, but it made sense. And there were people who could testify to the, you know, to its effectiveness. And there were people, you know, and it was more reasonably priced. And it seemed like, oh, that could be a good solution. So listen, anybody could be kind of tricked, because it's just, there's just, it's like the Wild West a little bit out there.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I think it's so important for the work that you're doing. You know, I've learned a lot from you, and I've learned through my patients' experiences, and I've learned first my own, and then my patients, and then, you know, and people like you along the way who are trying to like spread the right information, but it's so, so difficult, because it's basically hidden amongst all this other, like, you know, junk that is really unreliable. So think of all these people who are sick. They are allergic, quote unquote allergic, reacting to lots of things. They can eat three foods. Their skin is itching. Their throat is closing. They are ill in many, many, many ways, right? They think they have mast cell activation syndrome. Some of them have been confirmed to have mast cell activation syndrome, and they're using treatments to stop these dysfunctional mast cells from reacting, and they're not getting better because the trigger, the thing that is making their mast cells react, is still there. And some of them have figured out that mold is a problem, but they don't know what to do, or they can't do anything. They can't leave the home they're living in, or they don't have the resources to do anything else. So what do you, I know this is a tough question, but what can we tell people who are in the beginning stages of trying to figure this out, what they can do? Are there small things, small steps for the individual that they can, you know, do, think about, read?
Yeah, I mean, I think first off, you know, getting an education is going to be invaluable, right? Understanding the different steps that you have to take, I think, is really crucial. You know, because if you don't have resources, wasting resources on something, on things that don't work, that is a mistake that cannot be made. And, you know, I talk to people all the time, and not everybody can even remediate, right? And they're stuck, and they're in this situation where they're too sick to work, so they can't actually go and make money to even pay for the remediation, but yet they can't stay there because they're just going to continue to get sick. And so we have people all the time that reach out, and they're in this catch-22, and it's like, look, there are two main things you can do. And this is easy to say and hard to execute when you're not well. But the reality of it is dilution, right? You may have heard this, like, this anomaly, the solution to pollution is dilution, right?
Right.
So, you know, obviously it's an interesting statement, but in this reality, opening windows, okay, is going to be a lot, like, very helpful, because now you're diluting the amount of particles and toxins you're breathing in, because you're introducing fresh air. Now, of course, that air could have some particles and toxins with it as well, but at least, you know, depending on how bad the place is or the room is, depending on where you are, this could be a really smart strategy, right? Actually bringing fresh air into the house and diluting the amount that you're inhaling. Now, you know, there are different times of year where humidity might be higher, the heat might be higher, might be uncomfortable. So I understand, like, there are challenges to this, but, you know, thinking about what can I do if I'm stuck, I'd be opening windows and doors as much as possible. I'd be getting as much fresh air as possible. You know, that's something that I think is a big thing that people can do. The second thing is, again, easy to say, hard to execute, but cleaning the home. You know, if I've been sick and I've been bedridden, odds are I probably haven't been able to clean the house very well. And there might be dust accumulating. Well, what's in that dust is going to be things like mold, things like bacteria, toxins, VOCs, formaldehyde. I mean, the amount of things that are in our dust, probably staggering, just like when we think about all the chemicals and stuff that could be in our water. And so when we think about it from this perspective, you know, might be difficult to do, but finding the energy to clean the place might actually give us more energy in the end, because we're eliminating the amount of toxins, mold, bacteria, stuff, et cetera, that we're coming into contact with. Other things we can do, I mean, HVAC filtration. We can upgrade the HVAC filtration that we have. You know, maybe I have a MERV 8. I've just got a standard filter because no one's told me any better that I could, you know, buy a better filter. Going and getting the MERV 13 filter, you know, something that I can upgrade right there that might have better protection for me and my HVAC system. Getting my HVAC system cleaned, you know, professionally might be something that could be very cost effective and give me some value, especially if I'm concerned about mold in the HVAC system, right? And so these are things that people can do. It might not address, you know, the mold that's in the wall, right? Because that does need to be remediated. But at least if I'm able to kind of switch rooms and open doors and windows and clean and, you know, get some cheap air purifiers for $100 or something, you know, I'm starting to take action. And, you know, one thing that I think is true is just taking action, just taking any steps, you start to see results. And, you know, call it a placebo effect if you want. But I think just getting into that mindset that I'm going to conquer this, this will not conquer me, I think is going to make a profound difference. And taking those steps, no matter how small they might seem, you might actually notice a big difference. And that might give you the boost you need to take those additional steps to really try to either get out of the apartment if I'm renting or create a healthier home if I am the homeowner. And so I think, you know, hopefully those can resonate with people.
That's very helpful. That's very helpful because that's what people need, just like a start that might alleviate, you know, a little bit of their symptoms.
Absolutely. Can I ask you what you would say to the contractor who says, well, just take soap and water and clean the mold off the lumber and then go ahead and put your paneling up and you're fine?
Well, that's a tricky question. So there are some camps out there that like to use soap and water. I think, could you use soap and water? Sure, but you have to abrasively remove the mold first. And I don't think soap and water is going to do it. Now, you also might be talking about this from a context of like, okay, I have mold growing in my drywall. And so just take soap and water to the surface of the drywall. No, that's not going to be enough. That'd be like, you have weeds in your garden, you just go out and cut the head of the weed off. No. If you don't pull it from its roots out, unfortunately, it's going to grow right back, right? And so from that perspective, soap and water to your walls like that, no. But, you know, you will hear some camps talk about how, you know, if you do it right, you could use something as simple as soap and water. And so what they're talking about from that perspective is they're talking about like after you remove the porous contents, you can use something like soap and water to clean up the byproducts. Which again is fine because there's surfactant, you know, in the mix that they're talking about. But I personally like, you know, botanical antimicrobials just because, just like I like antimicrobial soap when I'm washing my hands, right? I want to have extra protection against microbes that I might not want in my house as I'm cleaning my house, right? And so, you know, it's a tricky subject, obviously, because you've got different schools of thoughts and there's different contexts and variables. But now, if you're just trying to wipe mold off your walls, that's not gonna solve your problem, unfortunately.
And it also seems like some of the contractors out there think that the stain is the problem, and as long as you make it look nice, then you're fine. But what I'm guessing that you would say is just because you've removed the appearance doesn't mean that it's all taken care of necessarily.
Well, you know, from that logic, you could just paint over the stain and then the stain would look less apparent, right? And so, you know, that logic doesn't really work. I think the stain is indicative of an issue, right? And so I can't tell you how many times I've seen like a stain underneath someone's sink, just to give you an example. And I actually saw the data come back because we had a swab taken of that stain or something. And there was actually like quite a bit of aspergillus, right? Personally, I don't want to have quite a bit of aspergillus under my sink, but you know, that stain that most contractors would have been like, oh, it's just a little stain, it's no problem, there's no mold there. There might be, right? And so this is why I think why in the remediation space, like I think testing is important because testing validates the presence of or not of certain species of mold. And if the goal is to eliminate certain species of molds, especially when they're of high quantity. I think validating, you know, if there is mold present or not is probably a smart maneuver. I think when you're remediating that stain, what you'll notice as you're actually cleaning it thoroughly, that stain will lessen and lessen until it's really almost, you know, not even visible at all. And so, yeah, I mean, those are my thoughts on that.
So there's the appearance of mold, which is not always 100% correlated with mold. And forgive me for being still sort of new to this, but you talked about spores and you talked about mycotoxins. And so do you mind giving, like, for those of us who are newbies, like the primer on what are those three things and kind of how much do you have to work to make sure that all three of them are gone?
Yeah, so that's a great question. First off, after this, I'm going to email you a YouTube link that I want you to look at. It's really interesting. I found it on YouTube the other day. And actually, it's a under a microscope, it's a colony of mold, and it's showing you how the spores are coming off of it. It looks like a volcano, honestly, of just like spores just constantly spewing out. And obviously that some of those particles could be toxins too. And that's dependent upon mold self-defense mechanism. It creates toxins as a self-defense mechanism, like a skunk, you know, would skunk you, right? When it feels threatened. So, you know, typically the molds themselves are threatened by the molds themselves. So you might have like Aspergillus fighting with Stachybotrys. They're trying to take over the same real estate, right? And so, you know, it's you have to have the organism first, right? The organism comes first. And when you have that organism start to grow and colonize, then it's going to look to reproduce. And as it's reproducing, those spores, just like that volcano, I mean, when you watch this video, you'll see exactly what I mean. It's so fascinating.
We'll
put the link in the show notes too. When you look at it from that perspective, you start to see all this stuff spewing off. You really start to understand, okay, wow, so this is being produced like every second, just hundreds of these things every second, depending on how big the colony is, could be thousands of these every second, could be hundreds of thousands, could be millions, right? All of it depends. I mean, 250,000 spores can fit on the head of a pin, just to give you some perspective here. So when we go at it from that, you know, we have to understand, okay, so we have the organism, we have to remove the organism, right? The organism that actually has roots that grow into our buildings, want to remove that organism. Then we realize, well, that organism has been there for however long it's been there, right? Maybe it's been 5 years, maybe it's been 5 days, who knows? But as long as it's been there, just like that volcano, it's just been spewing stuff into the environment. And now we're concerned about the spores, we're concerned about the toxins. I mean, if you've ever heard a story of somebody saying they removed all the mold, but they still didn't feel well, it's because probably all of the lava from the volcano is still all over their house and they're still being exposed to that, even though they got rid of the volcano, right? And so, you know, we're looking at it from this perspective of, okay, we have to figure out what allowed that organism to grow in the first place, and then how do we solve that problem? And then what about all the stuff it's created as long as it's been there, and how do we solve that problem? You know, and so that's really part of this process of how it works. And so look at the spore as like you would a seed. And I think it'll start to make more sense.
Okay, that's really helpful. Thank you.
Oh, it's a lot. It's a lot to think about. And again, when you don't have reliable information until now, right? I know that, listen, what you're trying to do is, I think, revolutionary and it's necessary. But until now, really, you know, it's the information is mixed. There are definitely inspectors that I've spoken to and remediators that I've spoken to who don't understand or believe in the mycotoxin role in illness. I don't know how you cannot believe. It's sort of weird to me. It's like, well, it's there, you know, but they don't know how to test. They don't know how to confirm that. There's a lot of controversy about testing. Can we talk a little bit about home testing? And,
sure.
And, you know, I have patients who, you know, I'll tell them I'm suspicious of mold. I might do a mycotoxin test on them. Let's say I find some trichothecenes, which, you know, in my mind, you know, so for people who don't know, they're these different mycotoxins can be these different toxins, they can be released by different species of molds. And there's some overlap. But when I see trichothecene, for instance, I immediately think about Stachybotrys as one a type of mold that makes trichothecene. And Stachybotrys, you know, some people would call, quote unquote, black mold. Although, you know, I hesitate to say that because we now understand that some mold is sort of invisible, right? And yeah. You may not see it. So it doesn't have to be black. Yep. But that's sort of like the teaching. That was how I was taught, right? So I'm going to put it out there. But you don't need to see Stachybotrys. But if I see trichothecenes, I'm already thinking, okay, this could be the problem. So they call an inspector, and the inspector comes to the house and looks around and doesn't see anything. Now, that already concerns me because the patient has already told me that they have suspicions that there's been water intrusion. So, like, can't be normal. But anyway, and then the mold inspector says, okay, we're going to put this thing in the middle of the room to collect air samples. And then we're going to, based on these air samples, we're going to see whether you have mold. And then the air sampling comes back with some spores of like Aspergillus, but it's not more than the Aspergillus outside, which is what they're comparing it to, because by the way, there is Aspergillus and mold outside. And especially the time, depending on the time of the year, depending on the season, especially in New York, right? Sure. This is the season right now. We're getting close to it, not quite now, but maybe in a few weeks, when the leaves start to come down and it gets wet and moldy. And guess what? Aspergillus. So anyway, these mold inspectors will say, well, you have some, you know, a few spores, but it's not more than outside. So you're fine.
All right. So to address the first thing you said about mycotoxins, you know, the FDA regulates mycotoxins in our food supply. Don't ask me how well or even how, okay, but they do. And so obviously we understand that mycotoxins, not only are they real, not only are they produced by mold, but they're a problem. And we have tons of studies on how mycotoxins are carcinogenic and immune system disruptors and all kinds of things, right? And so this is all known literature. Now, why a mold professional might not know or understand that, it's unless you are somebody who physically looks into that information, you just might not be aware of it. And unfortunately, I've been in this industry for over 10 years now, and I can tell you this year is like the first year that I've seen mycotoxins mentioned in some of the teachings for our continuing education classes. And so I bet 10 years from now, you'll see more mold professionals talking about it. But, it, you know, unfortunately, things take time. Now, with respects to testing and home testing, story you told me about basically someone coming in and they do an air sample in the center of the room. And, you know, as long as it's less than outside, everybody thinks it's fine. That is a flawed ideology because, yep. You know, first off, the air cassette only collects 75 milliliters of air. Think of a 2-liter bottle of Pepsi right now, okay? 2 liters, 75 milliliters. It's a very, very small fraction of that 2-liter bottle of Pepsi. Now, think about a 10 by 10 room. I'm in like maybe a 10 by 12 room right now. I mean, I could probably put hundreds of 2-liter bottles of Pepsi in this thing, okay? And we're talking about something that is like the size of the cap almost, right? That's how much air they're collecting. Okay, so when you put that in perspective, the further away I test from a source of mold, the more it looks like there's no mold.
Right.
Okay. And so, and again, when you watch this video that I hope everyone watches on the little volcano thing I'm talking about, when you see that video, you'll really start to understand. It's just spewing out. It's not controlled. It's not like there's a fan attached where it's blowing into the center of the room. It's just spewing out. And what did we learn from COVID, right? Remember the magic rule, 6 feet apart, everybody's got to be 6 feet apart, right? And so what we learned is something so small, like a virus or bacteria or mold, it's very light, doesn't travel through the air very much. This is why you want to stay 6 feet apart from somebody, because it's very unlikely for it to travel that 6 feet. However, here's where the variables are. Once it aerosolizes, it's going to attach to dust that's already in the air. Okay. Now, if you've ever sat near a window on a sunny day and you saw the light refract off the dust and you're like, listen, I don't get it. I clean my house 100 times. I have air purifiers. There's still dust everywhere, right? It's nothing you could do about that, unfortunately. But these microbes, they attach to the dust. They hitch a ride on the dust. They become part of the dust. Now, we've already seen that ray of light. You know that our dust is everywhere. Well, you are inhaling that dust that has viruses and bacteria and mold and you name it. And so that I want people to understand that. Now, if that's the case, Michael, how come the air test doesn't pick up the spores in the dust? Because the dust is too big to fit in the cassette. It's designed to capture small, tiny particles. So it's not picking up the dust in the cassette. Therefore, you're missing most of whatever might be happening in that room by testing in the center of the room. Now, I've been saying this for a long time. Ask me how many inspectors are still testing in the center of the room, right? It's just, I don't know if it's laziness or if it's just a misunderstanding of the technology or whatever it may be, but it's like time in and time out. I did an air sample in the center of the room. Guess what? There's less aspergillus inside than outside. Therefore, your house is not a problem. And it's like, well, that's not exactly accurate, right? Based upon all the reasons that I told you. So I think testing the dust, people might have heard of things like ERMI, right, before. I think testing the dust is a better barometer, like a better screening tool as to what you're being exposed to. I'm not going to say it's perfect either, right? It's not a perfect scientific technology, but it is far better understanding what I'm being exposed to across like as a screening tool than doing an air sample in the center of every room across your house. And it'll probably be cheaper too.
Well, it's mind blowing. And I am thinking about your website right now, the changetheairfoundation.org, and thinking about how many different kinds of information it has. And I'm really grateful that it has information about every step of this process. So I guess I just want listeners to know that if they're feeling overwhelmed right now, like, oh my gosh, I'm supposed to know about this and this and this and this, I think your website does an amazing job of walking people through and having lots of videos. And you had mentioned that 5-something CRC document, I forget what it's called exactly, but that is amazing. I think that's the end all be all of what the expert consensus is on mold remediation, right? So I guess I just want to assure our listeners that if they're at all confused or overwhelmed right now, it's all on your website.
Oh yeah. Yes, I know this can be overwhelming, of course, to think about. You know, if you go there, there's a little resources tab and you click start here. We broke everything down into 5 simple steps. And you don't read all 5 steps at one. You start at one. You know, you don't click 2 until you're done with 1. And that's the way to do it, just step by step. And it starts to take the overwhelm and make it more simplistic, because it really is simple. I know it sounds complex because we're talking about some science and microbiology and mixing that all with how that relates to our health. I mean, it could be a lot to take in one sitting. But you just have to understand it's a step-by-step process, you know, and when you break it down into those 5 simple steps, it becomes a lot easier. And I think we do a really good job on the website of giving people the information, how do you vet somebody, right? And I think that's really important, because we've talked about several times today, we've got 6 different people, you get 6 different things. This person wants a test here. And we have part of our actual step-by-step process. We go through all the different types of testing technologies that exist, how they should be used, what an inspection should look like. You know, an inspection, by the way, should take several hours at your home. But just like when you buying a home and you get a home inspection, it takes some hours, because they really should be surveying the outside, the inside. Really, one of the key pieces to this puzzle is where to test, right? I already mentioned testing in the center room is no good. Well, how do we use air tests then? Well, you want to test as close to where you suspect there might be an issue as possible. I mean, how close could you do it? Well, you could literally drill a hole through the wall, stick a tube through the wall, and take it from behind the wall, which is the most likely candidate for where it would be growing. And so how do you do that, though? Well, you have to first have at least some understanding of homes and buildings, and you have to have at least some tools or technologies like infrared cameras or moisture meters that give you a sense to what might be happening. I mean, even high-powered flashlights, you actually take a flashlight and you shine it down, you know, parallel with the wall, actually. And you might notice some stains or things that you didn't notice before that might give you a clue to, hey, let's test this wall. And so, you know, you really need to understand the different types of technologies so that you could ask the inspectors, hey, are you going to do this and do that? Because if they say, no, I'm just going to, oh, just don't worry. We're going to set up a pump in the center of your house. So we're going to take an air sample. We'll take an air sample outside, compare it to outside, you know, then you know that that might not give you the information that you're looking for, which, look, if you think your house is contributing to your health, I think you want to find something, you know, you want that answer as to what's going on, because then you could fix it, right? You certainly can't fix it if you don't know what's wrong. And so when people come in to tell you your house looks clean and it looks immaculate and there's no way there's mold, just based upon looking at the house visually, you know, I mean, it probably feels really good to hear, but it's not helpful because it doesn't allow me to actually take a next step. And so that guide specifically is written with that mindset of, these are the technologies and tools you should know. These are the questions you really should be asking. And this is how you find the right people to help you.
And the reality, right, of the situation, Michael, is that, as you sort of alluded to earlier, this is really a pervasive problem. I think it's going to get worse. Some of it from the building practices that you discussed. So there may be so many other factors, but I think it's getting worse. At least the number of patients that I'm seeing. Maybe it's because I'm tuned in. Maybe it's because of the patient population. But I just think that, you know, This is the time to, even if you don't think this is what's going on, you need to educate yourself so that if something should happen, you know, I'll give you an example, since I've been through a mold remediation already several times, and fortunately, and I've learned a lot from the experience. The minute we have a leak somewhere, which unfortunately we had recently again, don't ask, we are on it. Yesterday type of thing, you know, like we know how quickly mold can grow. We've learned the process. We know now, you know, how that you have to rip everything up right away in a certain amount of space. Like you can't just be like, okay, I'm going to cut a little hole here. So we've learned. And so I guess I encourage everyone, whether they think they're being exposed to mold or not, to just be aware. Because I think you can be more proactive, first off, if something happens, but also proactive to prevent it from happening in the first place, which is also, I think, a big step.
Yeah, I mean, prevention is obviously worth so much more than the cure, right? And you said something really interesting about how you think this problem's getting worse. I agree, and I'll bake it into some data for you.
Yeah.
But I've been around doing this for over 10 years now. I think I'm on my 12th year here. And I can tell you factually, it's definitely getting worse. Like the amount of calls just continues to increase and increase. But it's not just that. If you look at the EPA and HUD's joint study, the American Healthy Home Survey, they did the American Healthy Home Survey, I think it was 2006, American Healthy Home Survey 2, which was done in 2019. So it's span of about 13 years. Every single mold, with the exception of one, so 35 of the 36 molds that they tested for went up in prevalence, every single one. And when you look at it from that perspective, that tells you, okay, the houses are getting worse, not better, right? And so I think we're staring down the potential of a pretty serious epidemic that unfortunately probably will get worse before it gets better. And if we want this to really end with us, you know, we really need to actually start to become more aware, become more educated, you know, help out where we can. I mean, we have a whole program. If you've been listening to this and you want to like volunteer to change laws in your state, by the way, you can do that. I mean, we have a whole page that tells you really how to contact your legislators, how to basically get the process started. And then we already have the format of the bill that we can introduce to them and kind of take over from there. But, you know, it's, if we don't do something about this, you know, I don't know who will. And that's just the hard honest truth, because builders are still building the way they're building. The building community, and I'm just going to be honest, has gotten worse over the years, not better. Home insurance companies have gotten worse, not better. I mean, I actually just had a leak in my house too, Dr. Dempsey, and I called my insurance company. It was probably one of the funniest conversations I think I ever had, but not in a good way. And they would not cover the claim unless a hole was made in either the side of my house or in my roof before they would cover the claim. And I live in Florida. If you haven't heard about Florida, insurance is already expensive here because of the hurricanes, right? But I'm like, wait a second. So I pay you all of this money. I pay them a lot of money, okay? And you're telling me that I don't even know what this will cost, but I'm looking at it. It's really not that big of a deal, right? You should definitely cover this. You're telling me you won't cover this unless something like a missile made a hole in my house or my roof. Basically, they want like a tree branch to come through my house or something.
Wow.
So naturally now I'm like, I have to shop around, you know, for other insurance companies again. And it's like, and I know this stuff. I read all the fine print. So I wasn't sure like what happened exactly. I think it was like, it's something that slipped through on a renewal. Okay.
Yeah.
This happens to people every day. Every day people have leaks and issues, and they pay all this money for homeowners insurance, and then when they go to cover it, it's like, hey, yeah, we'll write you a check for $2,500 because that's what you have for mold coverage. Now, 20, 30 years ago, there was no mold coverage. It was you just were covered. You had mold. You were covered up to your policy limit, which could be like $300,000, half a million, whatever your policy limit is. Now, it's like you have maybe $10,000 if you're lucky, and that's it. And so anything above that $10,000 would be on you, the homeowner, to pay for. And so we have a big problem there. You guys already, I don't have to preach to the choir to you about health insurance, right? I mean, you know, health insurance isn't accepted, right? There's no health insurance for mold toxicity, is there? No. There's an ICD-10 code from the World Health Organization, but that hasn't translated over into American health insurance policies, right? And so, yeah, like I said earlier, we have big problems. You know, the work is far from over. But you know, just to be able to understand where we're going, and the fact that you have an organization that really does understand how to solve this problem, and it's not going to be complex, but it's going to require government stepping in and making sure that people are building homes better, people are insuring homes better. You know, and that when they are sick and things, the chips are down, they've got resources to get proper treatment. And unfortunately, that today that doesn't exist. But we hope that tomorrow, through the work of the foundation, that it will.
Thank you so much for the work that you're doing. And I'm honored to be on the medical advisory panel for Change the Air Foundation. I love the work that you're doing, and however I can help, I'm there. And is there anything left that you want to make sure that we cover today? I mean, we can talk for hours. I wish we could. We'll have to have you back on again. But any, you know, last thoughts?
No, just I you know, I want to thank you guys so much for even thinking of me to have me on here. And sign up for our newsletter if you can. It's we don't bombard you, I promise, but get some really good stuff going on in there every week or so.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Wow, Michael, Dr. Dempsey, thank you so much. I have to say that as a patient, what I'm hearing is that the construction companies are kind of organizing to cover their butts to not be liable about this. And I saw some of that when I looked into it. The homeowners insurance is making sure that their liability is limited. The health insurance is not covering any of it. And except for this foundation, I feel like patients are really on their own trying to figure out what's what. So I am just so grateful. And I feel like, you know, whether somebody has had this happen to them already or not, it pays to know about you and to get familiar with your resources, because boy, if you can prevent this, it's sounds like such a nightmare if you have it happen full on to you. And thank you for providing the education on how to prevent it, if that's where people are at, or to have solutions if, unfortunately, that's where they're at.
Yeah, thank you guys too. You know, I can't do this alone, obviously. And thank you for recognizing all the hard work. And, you know, obviously thanks to my amazing team that's helped me really make this come to life, because we wouldn't be this way without them either. And so, you know, it's going to take a village of us to make change, but we've got a pretty good start to this village here.
Sounds like it.
Well, hey, listeners, that's all for now, but we'll be back again next week with a normal episode of the podcast, and we'll be back again soon with another episode of Mast Cell Matters with Dr. Tanya Dempsey as our special host. So thank you for listening. May your mast cells be good to you, and please join us again soon.
As a reminder, anything you hear on this podcast is not medical advice. Consult your healthcare team about what's right for you. This show is a production of Standing Up to POTS, which is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. You can send us feedback or make a tax-deductible donation at www.standinguptopots.org. You can also engage with us on social media at the handle Standing Up to POTS. If you like what you heard today, please consider subscribing to our podcast and sharing it with your friends and family. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts or at www.thepotscast.com. Thanks for listening.